Mercy isn't strained. There are millions of us who live and die by the idea, but we have things like this waiting. Yes. She said, he never should have got that thing, but he didn't know. What thing? What thing? She agreed and nodded. I want the train. I want to get out of here before the big boy comes. After that, we both lapsed into silence. Elizabeth closed her eyes and appeared to doze off in her wheelchair. For something to do, I got out of my own chair, which would have looked at home in a gentleman's club, and approached the table. I plucked up a china girl and boy, looked at them, then put them aside. I scratched absently at the arm that wasn't there, studying the senseless litter before me. There had to be at least 100 figures on the polished length of oak, maybe 200. Among them was a china woman with an old-fashioned cap on, a milkmaid's cap, I thought. But I didn't want her, either. The cap was wrong, and besides, she was too young. I found another woman with long painted hair, and she was better. That hair was a little too long and a little too dark, but... No, it wasn't, because Pam had been to the beauty parlor, sometimes known as the midlife crisis fountain of youth. I held the china figure, wishing I had a house to put her in and a book for her to read. I tried to switch the figurine to my right hand, perfectly natural because my right hand was there, I could feel it, and it fell to the table with a clack. It didn't break, but Elizabeth's eyes opened. Dick, was that the train? Did it whistle? Did it cry? Not yet, I said. Why don't you nap a little? Oh, you'll find it on the second floor landing, she said, as if I had asked her something else, and closed her eyes again. Call me when the train comes. I'm so sick of the station. And watch for the big boy. That cunt liquor could be anywhere. I will, I said. My right arm itched horribly. I reached into my back pocket, hoping my notebook was there. It wasn't. I'd left it on the kitchen counter back at Big Pink. But that made me think of the Palazzo kitchen. There was a notepad for messages on the counter where I'd left the tin. I hurried back, snatched up the pad, stuck it between my teeth, then almost ran back to the china parlor, already pulling my uniball pen from my breast pocket. I sat down in my wingback chair and began to sketch the china doll rapidly, while the rain whipped the windows and Elizabeth sat leaning in her wheelchair across the table from me, dozing with her mouth ajar. The wind-driven shadows of the palms flew around the walls like bats. It didn't take long, and I realized something as I worked. I was pouring the itch out through the tip of the pen, decanting it onto the page. The woman in my drawing was the china figure, but she was also Pam. The woman was Pam, but she was also the china figure. Her hair was longer than when I'd last seen her and spread out on her shoulders. She was sitting in the burn, the char. A chair. What chair? A rocking chair. Hadn't been any such item in our house when I left it, but there it was now. Something was on the table beside her. I didn't know what it was at first, but it emerged from the tip of the pen and became a box with printing across the top. Sweet Owen? Did it say Sweet Owen? No, it said Grandma's. My uniball put something on the table beside the box, an oatmeal cookie, Pam's favorite. While I was looking at it, the pen drew the book in Pam's hand. Couldn't read the title because the angle was wrong. By now my pen was adding lines between the window and her feet. She'd said it was snowing, but now the snow was over. The lines were meant to be sun rays. I thought the picture was finished, but apparently there were two more things. My pen moved to the far left side of the paper and added the television, quick as a flash. New television, flat screen like Elizabeth's. And below it, the pen finished and fell away. The itch was gone. My fingers were stiff. On the other side of the long table, Elizabeth's doze had deepened into real sleep. Once she might have been young and beautiful. Once she might have been some young man's dream baby. Now she was snoring with her mostly toothless mouth pointed at the ceiling. If there's a God, I think he needs to try a little harder. 8. I had seen a phone in the library as well as the kitchen, and the library was closer to the china parlor. I decided neither Wireman nor Elizabeth would begrudge me a long-distance call to Minnesota. I picked up the phone, then paused with it curled to my chest. On a wall next to the suit of armor, highlighted by several cunning little pin spots in the ceiling, was a display of antique weapons. A long-barreled muzzle loader that looked of Revolutionary War vintage, a flintlock pistol, a derringer that would have been at home in a riverboat gambler's boot, a Winchester carbine. Mounted above the carbine was a gadget Elizabeth had been holding in her lap the day Ilsa and I had seen her. To either side, making an inverted V, were four loads for the thing. You couldn't call them arrows, they were too short. Harpoonlets seemed to be the right word. Their tips were very bright and looked very sharp. I thought, you could do some real damage with a thing like that. Then I thought, my father was a skin diver. I pushed it out of my mind and called what used to be home. 9. Hi, Pam. It's me again. I don't want to talk to you anymore, Edgar. We finish what we have to say. Not quite, but this will be short. I have an old lady to look after. She's sleeping now, but I don't like to leave her long. Pam, curious in spite of herself. What old lady? Her name's Elizabeth Eastlake. She's in her mid-80s, and she's got a good start on Alzheimer's. Her principal caregiver is taking care of an electrical problem with someone's sauna, and I'm helping out. Did you want a gold star to paste on the Helping Others page of your workbook? No. I called to convince you I'm not crazy. I had brought in my drawing. Now I crooked the handset between my shoulder and my ear so I could pick it up. Why do you care? Because you're convinced that all this started with Ilsa, and it didn't. My God, you're unbelievable. If she called from Santa Fe and said she'd broken a shoelace, you'd fly out there to take her a new one. I also don't like you thinking that I'm down here going insane when I'm not. So, are you listening? Only silence from the other end, but silence was good enough. She was listening. Your tanner may be 15 minutes out of the shower. I think that because your hair is down on the back of your house coat. I guess you still don't like the hairdryer. How? I don't know how. You were sitting in a rocking chair when I called. You must have gotten it since the divorce. Reading a book and eating a cookie. A grandma's oatmeal cookie. The sun's out now, and it's coming in the window. You have a new television, the kind with a flat screen. I paused. And a cat. You got a cat. It's sleeping under the TV. Dead silence from her end. On my end, the wind blew and the rain slapped the windows. I was about to ask her if she was there when she spoke again, in a dull voice that didn't sound like Pam at all. I had thought she was done hurting my heart, but I was wrong. Stop spying on me. If you ever loved me, stop spying on me. Then stop blaming me, I said in a hoarse, not quite breaking voice. Suddenly I remembered Ilsa getting ready to go back to Brown. Ilsa standing in the strong tropical sun outside the Delta terminal, looking up at me and saying, "You deserve to get better." Sometimes I wonder if you really believe that. What's happened to me isn't my fault. The accident wasn't my fault, and neither is this. I didn't ask for it. She screamed, "Do you think I did?" I closed my eyes, begging something, anything, to keep me from giving back anger for anger. No, of course not. Then leave me out of it. Stop calling me. Stop scaring me. She hung up. I stood holding the phone to my ear. There was silence, then a loud click. It was followed by that distinctive Duma key warbling hum. Today it sounded rather subaqueous, maybe because of the rain. I hung the phone up and stood looking at the suit of armor. "I think that went very well, Sir Lancelot," I said. No reply, which was exactly what I deserved. 10. I crossed the plant-lined main hall to the doorway of the china parlor, looked in at Elizabeth, and saw she was sleeping in the same head-cocked position. Her snores, which had earlier struck me as pathetic in their naked antiquity, were now actually comforting. Otherwise, it would have been too easy to imagine her sitting there dead with her neck broken. I wondered if I should wake her, and decided to let her sleep. Then I glanced right, toward the wide main staircase and thought of her saying, "Oh, you'll find it on the second floor landing." Find what? Probably it had been just another bit of gibberish, but I had nothing better to do, so I walked down the hall that would have been a dog trot in a humbler house, the rain tapping the glass ceiling, and then climbed the wide staircase. I stopped 5 risers from the top, staring, then slowly climbed the rest of the way. There was something, after all, an enormous black-and-white photograph in a frame of narrow banded gold. I asked Wireman later how a black-and-white from the 1920s could have been blown up to such a size. It had to have been at least 5 feet tall by 4 wide, with so little blurring. He said it had probably been taken with a Hasselblad, the finest non-digital camera ever made. There were 8 people in the photograph, standing on white sand, with the Gulf of Mexico in the background. The man was tall and handsome and appeared to be in his mid-40s. He was wearing a black bathing singlet that consisted of a strap-style shirt and trunks that looked like the close-fitting underwear basketball players wear nowadays. Ranged on either side of him stood 5 girls, the oldest a ripe teenager, the youngest identical towheads that made me think of the Bobbsey twins from my earliest adventures in reading. The twins were wearing identical bathing dresses with frilled skirts and holding hands. In their free hands, they clasped dangly-legged, apron-wearing Raggedy Ann dolls that made me think of Reba, and the dark yarn hair above the vacantly smiling faces of the twins' dolls was surely red. In the crook of one arm, the man, John Eastlake, I had no doubt, held girl number 6, the toddler who would eventually become the snoring crone below me. Behind the white folks stood a young black woman of perhaps 22, with her hair tied in a kerchief. She was holding a picnic basket, and judging from the way the not inconsiderable muscles in her arms were bunched, it was heavy. 3 bangled silver bracelets clung to 1 forearm. Elizabeth was smiling and holding out her chubby little hands to whoever had taken this family portrait. No one else was smiling, although there might have been the ghost of one lurking around the corners of the man's mouth. He had a mustache, and that made it hard to tell. The young black nanny looked positively grim. In the hand not occupied with supporting the toddler, John Eastlake held 2 items. One was a skin diver's face mask. The other was the harpoon pistol I had seen mounted on the wall of the library with the other weapons. The question, it seemed to me, was whether or not some rational Elizabeth had come out of the mental fog long enough to send me up here. Before I could consider this further, the front door opened below me. "I'm back," Wireman called. "Mission accomplished. Now who wants a drink?" How to Draw a Picture. 5. Don't be afraid to experiment. Find your muse and let her lead you. As her talent grew stronger, Elizabeth's muse became Noveen, the marvelous talking doll. Or so she thought. And by the time she discovered her mistake, by the time Noveen's voice changed, it was too late. But at first it must have been wonderful. Finding one's muse always is. The cake, for instance. "Make it go on the floor," Noveen says. "Make it go on the floor, Libet." And because she can, she does. She draws Nan Melda's cake on the floor, splattered on the floor, ha! And Nan Melda standing over it, hands on hips, disgusted. And was Elizabeth ashamed when it actually happened? Ashamed and a little frightened? I think she was. I know she was. For children, meanness is usually funny only when it's imagined. Still, there were other games, other experiments, until finally, in 27. In Florida, all out-of-season hurricanes are called Alice. It's a kind of joke. But the one that came screaming in off the Gulf in March of that year should have been named Hurricane Elizabeth. The doll whispered to her in a voice that must have sounded like the wind in the palms at night, or the retreating tide grating through the shells under Big Pink, whispering as little Libet lingered on the porch of sleep, telling her how much fun it would be to paint a big storm and more. Noveen says, "There are secret things, buried treasures a big storm will uncover, things Daddy would like to find and look at." And that turned the trick. Elizabeth cared only a little about painting a storm, but pleasing her daddy, that idea was irresistible. Because daddy was angry that year, mad at Addie, who wouldn't go back to school even after her European tour. Addie didn't care about meeting the right people or going to the right Deb balls. She was besotted with her Emery, who wasn't the right sort at all, in daddy's view of things. Daddy says he's not our kind, he's a celluloid collar. And Addie says he's my kind, no matter what collar. And Daddy's furious. There were bitter arguments. Daddy mad at Addie and vice versa. Hannah and Maria mad at Addie for having a handsome boyfriend who was both older and below her. The twins scared by all that mad. Libet scared, too. Nan Melda declared over and over that if not for Tessie and Lolo, she would have gone back to her people in Jacksonville long since. Elizabeth drew these things, so I saw them. The boil finally popped its top. Addie and her unsuitable young man eloped off to Atlanta, where Emery had been promised work in the office of a competitor. Daddy was raging. The big meanies, home from the Braden School for the weekend, heard him on the telephone in his study telling someone he'd have Emery Paulson brought back and horsewhipped within an inch of his life. He would have them both horsewhipped. Then he says, "No, by God, let it be what it is. She's made her bed, let her sleep in it." And after that came the storm, the Alice. Libet felt it coming. She felt the wind begin to rise and blow out of simple charcoal strokes as black as death. The size of the actual storm when it arrived, the pelting rain, the freight train shriek of the gale, frightened her badly, as if she had whistled for a dog and gotten a wolf. But then the wind died and the sun came out and everyone was all right. Better than all right. Because in the Alice's aftermath, Addie and her unsuitable young man were forgotten for a time. Elizabeth even heard Daddy humming as he and Mr. Shannington cleaned up the wreckage in the front yard. Daddy driving the little red tractor and Mr. Shannington throwing drowned palm fronds and busted branches into the little trailer trundling along behind. The doll whispered. The muse told its tale. Elizabeth listened and painted the place off Hag's Rock that very day, the one where Noveen whispered the buried treasure now lay exposed. Libet begs her daddy to go look, begs him, begs him, begs him. Daddy says no. Daddy says he's too tired, too stiff from all that yard work. Nan Melda says, "Sometime in the water might loosen you up, Mr. Eastlake." Nan Melda says, "I'll bring down a picnic lunch and the little girls." And then Nan Melda says, "You know how she is now. If she say something's out there, then maybe." So they went down beach by Hag's Rock, Daddy in the swimsuit that no longer fit him, and Elizabeth and the twins and Nan Melda. Hannah and Maria were back in school, and Addie, but best not to talk about her. Addie's in Dutch. Nan Melda was carrying the red picnic basket. Inside was the lunch, sun hats for the girls, Elizabeth's drawing things, Daddy's spear pistol, and a few harpoons for it. Daddy puts on his flippers and wades into the caldo, up to his knees, and says, "This is cold. It better not take long, Libet. Tell me where this fabulous treasure lies." Libet says, "I will, but do you promise I can have the China dolly?" Daddy says, "Any doll is yours. Fair salvage." The muse saw it, and the girl painted it. So their future is set. Nine. Candy Brown. One. Two nights later, I painted the ship for the first time. I called it Girl and Ship to begin with, then Girl and Ship Number One, although neither was its real name. Its real name was Ilsa and Ship Number One. It was the ship series, even more than what happened to Candy Brown, that decided me on whether or not to show my work. If Nanutzi wanted to do it, I'd go along. Not because I was seeking what Shakespeare called the bubble reputation. I owe Wireman for that one. But because I came to understand that Elizabeth was right, it was better not to let work pile up on Duma Key. The ship paintings were good, maybe great. They certainly felt that way when I finished them. They were also bad, powerful medicine. I think I knew that from the first one, executed during the small hours of Valentine's Day. during the last night of Tina Garibaldi's life. 2. The dream wasn't exactly a nightmare, but it was vivid beyond my power to describe in words, although I captured some of the feeling on canvas. Not all, but some. Enough, maybe. It was sunset. In that dream, and all the ones which followed, it was always sunset. Vast red light filled the west, reaching high to heaven, where it faded first to orange, then to a weird green. The gulf was nearly dead calm, with only the smallest and glassiest of rollers crossing its surface like respiration. In the reflected sunset glare, it looked like a huge socket filled with blood. Silhouetted against that furnace light was a three-masted derelict. The ship's rotted sails hung limp with red fire glaring through the holes and rips. There was no one alive on board. You only had to look to know that. There was a feeling of hollow menace about the thing, as though it had housed some plague that had burned through the crew, leaving only this rotting corpse of wood, hemp, and sailcloth. I remember feeling that if a gull or pelican flew over it, the bird would drop dead on the deck with its feathers smoking. Floating about 40 yards away was a small rowboat. Sitting in it was a girl, her back to me. Her hair was red, but the hair was false. No live girl had tangled yarn hair like that. What gave away her identity was the dress she wore. It was covered with tic-tac-toe grids, and the printed words, "I win, you win," over and over. Ilsa had that dress when she was 4 or 5, about the age of the twin girls in the family portrait I'd seen on the second floor landing of El Palacio de Asesinos. I tried to shout to warn her not to go near the derelict. I couldn't. I was helpless. In any case, it didn't seem to matter. She only sat there in her sweet little rowboat on the mild red rollers, watching and wearing Illy's tic-tac-toe dress. I fell out of my bed and on my bad side. I cried out in pain and rolled over on my back, listening to the waves from outside and the soft grinding of the shells under the house. They told me where I was, but did not comfort me. "I win," they said. "I win, you win. You win, I win. The gun. I win. The fruit, you win. I win, you win." My missing arm seemed to burn. I had to put a stop to it or go crazy. And there was only one way to do that. I went upstairs and painted like a lunatic for the next 3 hours. I had no model on my table, no object in view out my window, nor did I need any. It was all in my head. And as I worked, I realized this was what all the pictures had been struggling toward. Not the girl in the rowboat, necessarily. She was probably just an added attraction, a toehold in reality. It was the ship I had been after all along, the ship and the sunset. When I thought back, I realized the irony of that. Hello, the pencil sketch I'd made that day I came, had been the closest. 3. I tumbled into bed around 3:30 and slept until 9. I woke feeling refreshed, cleaned out, brand new. The weather was fine, cloudless and warmer than it had been in a week. The Baumgartens were getting ready to return north, but I had a spirited game of frisbee with their boys on the beach before they left. My appetite was high, my pain level low. It was nice to feel like one of the guys again, even for an hour. Elizabeth's weather had also cleared. I read her a number of poems while she arranged her chinas. Wireman was there, caught up for once, and in good spirits. The world felt fine that day. It occurred to me only later that George Candy Brown might well have been abducting 12-year-old Tina Garibaldi at the same time I was reading Richard Wilbur's poem about laundry, "Love Calls Us to the Things of the World," to Elizabeth. I chose it because I happened to see an item in that day's paper saying it had become something of a Valentine's Day favorite. The Garibaldi kidnapping happened to be recorded. It occurred at exactly 3:16 p.m., according to the timestamp on the tape. And that would have been just about the time I paused to sip from my glass of Wireman's green tea and unfold the Wilbur poem, which I had printed off the internet. There were closed-circuit cameras installed to watch the loading dock areas behind the Crossroads Mall, to guard against pilferage, I suppose. What they caught in this case was the pilferage of a child's life. She comes into view, crossing right to left, a slim kid dressed in jeans with a pack on her back. She was probably planning to duck into the mall before going the rest of the way home. On the tape, which the TV stations replayed obsessively, you see him emerge from a rampway and take her by the wrist. She turns her face up to his and appears to ask him a question. Brown nods in reply and leads her away. At first she's not struggling, but then, just before they disappear behind a dumpster, she attempts to pull free. But he's still holding her firmly by the wrist when they disappear from the camera's view. He killed her less than 6 hours later, according to the county medical examiner. But judging by the terrible evidence of her body, those hours must have seemed very long to that little girl, who never harmed anyone. They must have seemed endless. Outside the open window, the morning air is all awash with angels. Richard Wilbur writes, "In Love Calls Us to the Things of the World." But no, Richard. No. Those were only sheets. 4. The Baumgartens departed. The Godfreys' dogs barked them goodbye. A Merry Maid's crew went into the house where the Baumgartens had been staying and gave it a good cleaning. The Godfreys' dogs barked them hello and goodbye. Tina Garibaldi's body was found in a ditch behind the Wilk Park Little League field, naked from the waist down and discarded like a bag of garbage. Her mother was shown on Channel 6 screaming and harrowing at her cheeks. The Kintners replaced the Baumgartens. The folks from Toledo vacated number 39, and three pleasant old ladies from Michigan moved in. The old ladies laughed a lot and actually said yoo-hoo when they saw me or Wireman coming. I have no idea if they put the newly installed Wi-Fi at number 39 to use or not, but the first time I played Scrabble with them, they fed me my lunch. The Godfrey's dogs barked tirelessly when the old ladies went on their afternoon walks. A man who worked at the Sarasota Easy Jet Wash called the police and said the guy on the Tina Garibaldi tape looked very much like one of his fellow car washers, a guy named George Brown, known to everyone as Candy. Candy Brown had left work around 2:30 on Valentine's Day afternoon, this man said, and hadn't returned until the next morning, claimed he hadn't felt well. The Easy Jet Wash was only a block from the Crossroads Mall. 2 days after Valentine's, I came to the Palacio kitchen and found Wireman sitting at the table with his head thrown back, shaking all over. When the shake subsided, he told me he was fine. When I said he didn't look fine, he told me to keep my opinions to myself, speaking in a brusque tone that was unlike him. I held up three fingers and asked him how many he saw. He said three. I held up two, and he said two. I decided, not without misgivings, to let it go. Again, I was not, after all, my Wireman's keeper. I painted girl and ship numbers 2 and 3. In number 2, the child in the rowboat was wearing Reba's polka-dotted blue dress, but I was pretty sure it was still Ilsa. And in number 3, there was no doubt. Her hair had returned to the fine corn silk I remembered from those days, and she was wearing a sailor blouse with blue curlicue stitching around the collar that I had reason to remember very well. She'd been wearing it one Sunday when she'd fallen out of the apple tree at our backyard and broken her arm. In number 3, the ship had turned slightly, and I could read the first letters of its name on the prow in flaking paint. P-E-R. I had no idea what the rest of the letters might be. That was also the first painting with John Eastlake's spear pistol in it. It was lying loaded on one of the rowboat's seats. On the 18th of February, a friend of Jack's showed up to help with repairs to some of the rental properties. The Godfrey's dogs barked gregariously at him, inviting him to come on over any time he felt like having a chunk removed from his hip-hop jeans-clad buttski. Police questioned Candy Brown's wife. She also called him Candy. Everyone called him Candy. He had probably invited Tina Garibaldi to call him Candy before torturing and killing her, about his whereabouts on the afternoon of Valentine's Day. She said maybe he was sick, but he hadn't been sick at home. He hadn't come home until 8 o'clock or so that night. She said he had brought her a box of chocolates. She said he was an old sweetie about things like that. On the 21st of February, the country music folks took their sports car and went boot-scootin' back to the northern climes from whence they'd come. No one else moved in to take their place. Wireman said it signaled the turn of the snowbird tide. He said it always turned earlier on Duma Key, which had zero restaurants and tourist attractions, not even a lousy alligator farm. The Godfrey's dogs barked ceaselessly, as if to proclaim the tide of winter vacationers might have turned, but it was a long way from out. On the same day the boot scooters left Duma, the police showed up at Candy Brown's home in Sarasota with a search warrant. According to Channel 6, they took several items. A day later, the three old ladies at number 39 once more fed me my lunch at Scrabble. I never so much as sniffed a triple word score, but I did learn that Kiviet is a word. When I got home and snapped on the TV, the breaking news logo was on Channel 6, which is all Suncoast all of the time. Candy Brown had been arrested. According to sources close to the investigation, two of the items taken in the search of the Brown house were undergarments, one spotted with blood. DNA testing would follow as day follows night. Candy Brown didn't wait. The following day's newspaper quoted him as saying to police, "I got high and did a terrible thing." This was what I read as I drank my morning juice. Above the story was the picture, already as familiar to me as the photo of Kennedy being shot in Dallas. The picture showed Candy with his hand locked on Tina Garibaldi's wrist, her face turned up to his questioningly. The telephone rang. I picked it up without looking at it and said hello. I was preoccupied with Tina Garibaldi. It was Wireman. He asked if maybe I could come down to the house for a little while. I said, sure, of course. Started to say goodbye and then realized I was hearing something, not in his voice, but just under it, that was a long way from normal. I asked him what was wrong. "I seem to have gone blind in my left eye, muchacho." He laughed a little. It was a strange, lost sound. I knew it was coming, but it's still a shock. I suppose we'll all feel that way when we wake up. He drew a shuddering breath. "Can you come? I tried to get Anne-Marie from Bay Area Private Nursing, but she's out on a call. And can you come, Edgar, please?" "I'll be right there. Just hang on, Wireman. Stay where you are and hang on." 5. I hadn't had trouble with my own eyesight in weeks. The accident had caused some loss of peripheral vision, and I tended to turn right to look at things I'd formerly picked up easily while looking straight ahead, but otherwise I was fine in the vision department. Going out to my anonymous rental Chevy, I wondered how I'd feel if that bloody redness started to creep over things again, or if I woke up some morning with nothing but a black hole on one side of my world. That made me wonder how Wireman could have managed a laugh, even a little one. I had my hand on the Malibu's door handle when I remembered him saying that Anne-Marie Whistler, whom he depended upon to stay with Elizabeth when he had to be gone for any length of time, was on a call. I hurried back to the house and called Jack's mobile, praying that he'd answer and that he could come. He did, and he could. That was one for the home team. 6. I drove off the island for the first time that morning and broke my cherry in a big way, joining the bumper-to-bumper northbound traffic on the Tamiami Trail. We were bound for Sarasota Memorial Hospital. This was on the recommendation of Elizabeth's doctor, who I called over Wireman's weak protests. And now Wireman kept asking me if I was all right, if I was sure I could do this, if it wouldn't have been better to let Jack drive him so I could stay with Elizabeth. "I'm fine," I said. "Well, you look scared to death, I can see that much." His right eye had shifted in my direction. His left tried to follow suit, but without much success. It was bloodshot, slightly upturned, and welling careless tears. "You gonna freak out, muchacho?" "No. Besides, you hurt Elizabeth. If you hadn't gone on your own, she would have taken a broom and beaten you right out the door." He hadn't meant Miss Eastlake to know there was anything wrong with him, but she'd been coming into the kitchen on her walker and overheard his end of our conversation. And besides, she had a little of what Wireman had. It went unacknowledged between us, but it was there. "If they want to admit you," I began. "Oh, they'll want to. It's a fucking reflex with them. But it's not going to happen. If they could fix it, that would be different. I'm only going because Hadlock may be able to tell me this isn't a permanent clusterfuck, but just a temporary blip on the radar." He smiled wanly. "Wireman, what the hell's wrong with you?" All in good time, muchacho. What are you painting these days? Never mind right now. Oh, dear, Wireman said. Looks like I'm not the only one who's tired of questions. Did you know that during the winter months, one out of every 40 regular users of the Tamiami Trail will have a vehicular mishap? It's true. And according to something I heard on the news the other day, the chances of an asteroid the size of the Houston Astrodome hitting the Earth are actually better than the chances of... I reached for the radio and said, why don't we have some music? Good idea, he said, but no fucking country. For a second I didn't understand, and then I remembered the recently departed Boot Scooters. I found the area's loudest, dumbest rock station, which styles itself the Bone. There Nazareth was screaming its way through Hair of the Dog. Ah, puke on your shoes, rock and roll, Wireman said. Now you're talking, mi hijo. 7. That was a long day. Any day you drop your bod onto the conveyor belt of modern medicine, especially as it's practiced in a city overstuffed with elderly, often ailing winter visitors, you're in for a long day. We were there until 6. They did indeed want to admit Wireman. He refused. I spent most of my time in those purgatorial waiting rooms, where the magazines are old, the cushions on the chairs are thin, and the TV is always bolted high in one corner. I sat, I listened to worried conversations compete with the TV cackle, and every now and then, I went to one of the areas where cell phones were allowed and used Wireman's to call Jack. Was she good? She was terrific. They were playing Parcheesi, then reconfiguring Chinatown. The third time, they were eating sandwiches and watching Oprah. The fourth time, she was sleeping. Tell them she's made all her restroom calls, Jack said, so far. I did. Wireman was pleased to hear it, and the conveyor belt trundled slowly along. 3 waiting rooms, one outside general admitting, where Wireman refused to even take a clipboard with a form on it, possibly because he couldn't read it, I filled in the necessary information. One outside neurology, where I met both Jean Hadlock, Elizabeth's doctor, and a pallid goateed fellow named Herbert Principe. Dr. Hadlock claimed that Principe was the best neurologist in Sarasota. Principe did not deny this, nor did he say, shucks. The last waiting room was on the second floor, home of big fancy equipment. Here Wireman was taken not to magnetic resonance imaging, a process with which I was very familiar, but instead to X-ray at the far end of the hall, a room I imagined to be dusty and neglected in this modern age. Wireman gave me his Mary medallion to hold, and I was left to wonder why Sarasota's best neurologist would resort to such old-fashioned technology. No one bothered to enlighten me. The TVs in all 3 waiting rooms were tuned to Channel 6, where again and again I was subjected to the picture. Candy Brown with his hand locked on Tina Garibaldi's wrist, her face turned up to his, frozen in a look that was terrible because anyone brought up in a halfway decent home knew, in his or her heart, exactly what it meant. You told your children to be careful, very careful, that a stranger could mean danger, and maybe they believed it, but kids from nice homes had also been raised to believe that safety was their birthright. So the eyes said, sure, mister, tell me what I'm supposed to do. The eyes said, you're the adult, I'm the kid, so tell me what you want. The eyes said, I've been raised to respect my elders. And most of all, what killed you were the eyes saying, I've never been hurt before. I don't think that endless looping coverage and near-constant repetition of the picture accounts for everything that followed. But did it play a part? Yeah. Sure it did. 8. It was past dark when I finally drove out of the parking garage and turned south on the trail, headed back toward Duma. At first I hardly thought about Wireman. I was totally absorbed in my driving, somehow positive this time my luck would run out and we would have an accident. Once we got past the Siesta Key turnoffs and the traffic thinned a little, I started to relax. When we got to the Crossroads Mall, Wireman said, pull in. Need something at the Gap? Joe Boxers, couple of t-shirts with pockets? Don't be a smartass, just pull in. Park under a light. I parked under one of the lights and turned off the engine. I found it moderately creepy there, even though the lot was well over half full, and I knew that Candy Brown had taken Tina Garibaldi on the other side, the loading dock side. "I guess I can tell this once," Wireman said. "And you deserve to hear, because you've been good to me. And you've been good for me." "Right back at you on that, Wireman." His hands were resting on a slim gray folder he had carried out of the hospital with him. His name was on the tab. He raised one finger off it to still me without looking at me. He was looking straight ahead at the Bell's department store anchoring this end of the mall. "I want to do this all at once. That work for you?"
"Sure."
"My story is like..." He turned to me, suddenly animated. His left eye was bright red and weeping steadily, but at least now it was pointing at me along with the other one. "Muchacho, have you ever seen one of those happy news stories about a guy winning $200 or $300 million on the Powerball?" "Everyone has. They get him up on stage, they give him a great big fake cardboard check, and he says something which is almost always inarticulate, but that's good. In a situation like that, inarticulate is the point, because picking all those numbers is fucking outrageous. Absurd. In a situation like that, the best you can do is, 'I'm going to fucking Disney World.' Are you with me so far?"
"So far, yeah."
Wireman went back to studying the people going in and out of Bell's, behind which Tina Garibaldi had met Candy Brown to her pain and sorrow. "I won La Loteria too, only not in a good way. In fact, I'd say it was just about the world's worst way. The lawyering I did in my other life was in Omaha. I worked for a firm called Finem, Dooling, and Allen. Wits, of which I considered myself one, sometimes called it Find 'em, Fuck 'em, and Forget 'em. It was actually a great firm, honest as the day. We did good business, and I was well positioned there. I was a bachelor, and by that time I was 37. I thought that was probably my lot in life. Then the circus came to town, Edgar. I mean an actual circus, one with big cats and aerialists. Most of the performers were of other nationalities, as is often the case. The aerialist troupe and their families were from Mexico. One of the circus accountants, Julia Tavares, was also from Mexico. As well as keeping the books, she functioned as translator for the flyers." He gave her name the Spanish pronunciation Julia. "I did not go to the circus. Wireman does the occasional rock show. He doesn't do circuses. But here's the lottery again. Every few days the circus's clerical staff would draw slips from a hat to see who'd go shopping for the office snacks, chips, dips, coffee, soda. One day in Omaha, Julia drew the marked slip. While coming back across the supermarket parking lot to the van, a produce truck entering the lot at a high rate of speed struck a line of shopping carts. You know how they stack them up?"
"Yes."
"Okay. Bang. Carts roll 30 feet, strike Julia, break her leg. She was blindsided and had no chance to get out of the way. There happened to be a cop parked nearby, and he heard her screaming. He called an ambulance. He also breathalyzed the produce truck driver. He blew a 1.7.
"Is that bad?"
"Yes, muchacho. In Nebraska, a 1.7 means do not collect $200, go directly to drunk. Julia, on the advice of the doctor who saw her in the emergency room, came to us. There were 35 lawyers in Find 'em, Fuck 'em, and Forget 'em back then, and Julia's personal injury case could have ended up with any one of 15. I got it. Do you see the numbers starting to roll into place?"
"Yes."
"I did more than represent her. I married her. She wins the suit and a large chunk of change. The circus rolls out of town, as circuses have a way of doing, only minus one accountant. Shall I tell you we were very much in love?"
"No," I said. "I hear it every time you say her name."
"Thank you, Edgar. Thanks."
He sat there with his head bowed and his hands on his folder. Then he dragged a battered, bulging wallet from his hip pocket. I had no idea how he could bear to sit on such a rock.
He flipped through the little windows meant for photographs and important documents, then stopped and slid out a photograph of a dark-haired, dark-eyed woman in a white sleeveless blouse. She looked about 30. She was a heartstopper. "Mi Julia," he said. I started to hand the picture back, and he shook his head. He was choosing another photo. I dreaded to see it. I took it, though, when he handed it over.
It was Julia Wireman in miniature. That same dark hair, framing a pale, perfect face. Those same dark, solemn eyes. Esmeralda, Wireman said. The other half of my heart. Esmeralda, I said. I thought the eyes looking out of this photograph and the eyes looking up at Candy Brown in the picture were almost the same. But maybe all children's eyes are the same. My arm began to itch, the one that had been burnt up in a hospital incinerator. I scratched at it and got my ribs. No news there. Wireman took the pictures back, kissed each with a brief, dry ardor that was terrible to see, and returned them to their transparent sleeves. It took him a little while because his hands had picked up a tremble, and I suppose he was having trouble seeing. You actually don't even have to watch those old numbers, amigo. If you close your eyes, you can hear them falling into place, click and click and click. Some guys just strike lucky. Hacha. He popped his tongue against the roof of his mouth. The sound was shockingly loud in the little sedan. When Ez was three, Julia signed on part-time with an outfit called Workfare Immigration Solutions in downtown Omaha. She helped Spanish speakers with and without green cards get jobs, and she helped start illegals who wanted citizenship on the right road. Just a little storefront outfit, low profile, but they did a lot more practical good than all the marches and sign-waving, in Wireman's humble opinion. He pressed his hands against his eyes and drew a deep, shuddering breath. Then he let his palms fall on top of the file folder with a thump. When it happened, I was in Kansas City on business. Julia spent Monday to Thursday mornings at Workfare. Ez went to daycare. A good one. I could have sued and broken that place, beggared the woman who ran it, but I didn't. Because even in my grief, I understood that what happened to Esmeralda could have happened to anyone's child. It's all just la lotería, ¿entiendes? Once our firm sued a Venetian blind company, I wasn't personally involved, when a baby lying in his crib got hold of the draw cord, swallowed it, and choked to death. The parents won, and there was a payout, but their baby was just as dead. And if it hadn't been the cord, it might have been something else, a matchbox car, the ID tag off a dog's collar, a marble. Wireman shrugged. With Ez, it was the marble. She pulled it down her throat during playtime and choked to death. Wireman, Jesus, I'm so sorry. She was still alive when they got her to the hospital. The woman from the daycare called both Julia's office and mine. She was babbling crazy, insane. Julia went tearing out of Workfare, got into her car, drove like hell. 3 blocks from the hospital, she had a head-on collision with an Omaha Public Works truck. She was killed instantly. By then, our daughter had probably already been dead for 20 minutes. That Mary medallion you held for me? That was Julia's. He fell silent, and the silence spun out. I didn't feel it. There's nothing to say to a story like that. Eventually, he resumed. Just another version of the Powerball. 5 numbers, plus that all-important bonus number. Click, 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 click. And then clack, for good measure. Did I think such a thing could happen to me? No, muchacho. Never in my wildest. And God punishes us for what we can't imagine. My mother and dad begged me to go see a psychiatrist, and for a little while, 8 months after the funerals, I did indeed go. I was tired of floating through the world like a balloon tethered 3 feet over my own head. I know the feeling, I said. I know you do. We checked into hell on different shifts, you and me. And out again, I suppose. Although my heels are still smoking. How about yours? Yeah. The psychiatrist, nice man, but I couldn't talk to him. With him, I was inarticulate. With him, I found myself grinning a lot. I kept expecting a cute chick in a bathing suit to trot out my big cardboard check. The audience would see it and applaud. And eventually a check did come. When we married, I'd taken out a joint life insurance policy. When Ez came, I added to it. So I really did win La Loteria. Especially when you add the compensation Julia received from the accident in the supermarket parking lot. Which brings us to this. He held up the slim gray folder. The thought of suicide had been out there, circling closer and closer. The primary attraction was the idea that Julia and Esmeralda might also still be out there, waiting for me to catch up. But they might not wait forever. I'm not a conventionally religious man, but I think there's at least a chance that there is life after death, and that we survive as, you know, ourselves. But of course, a wintry smile touched the sides of his mouth. Mostly I was just depressed. I had a gun in my safe, a .22. I bought it for home protection after Esmeralda was born. One night I sat down with it at the dining room table, and I believe you might know this part of the story, muchacho. I raised one hand and seesawed it in a maybe see, maybe no gesture. I sat down at the dining room table in my empty house. There was a bowl of fruit there, courtesy of the home shopper I employed. I put the gun on the table, then I closed my eyes. I spun the bowl of fruit around two or three times. Told myself if I picked an apple out of the bowl, I'd put the gun to my temple and end my life. If it was an orange, however, I'd take my lottery winnings and go to Disney World. "You could hear the refrigerator," I said. "That's right," he said without surprise. "I could hear the fridge, both the hum of the motor and the clunk of the ice maker. I reached out and I picked an apple." "Did you cheat?" Wireman smiled. "A fair question. If you mean, did I peek? The answer is no. If you mean, did I memorize the geography of the fruit in the bowl?" He shrugged. "Quién sabe? In any case, I picked an apple. In Adam's fall, sinned we all. I didn't have to bite it or smell it. I could tell what it was by the skin. So without opening my eyes, or giving myself any chance to think, I picked up the gun and put it to my temple." He mimed this with the hand I no longer had, cocking the thumb and placing the first finger against the small circular scar that his long graying hair usually hid. My last thought was, at least I won't have to listen to that refrigerator anymore, or eat one more gourmet shepherd's pie out of it. I don't remember any bang. Nevertheless, the whole world went white. And that was the end of Wireman's other life. "Now, would you like the hallucinogenic shit?" "Yes, please." "You want to see if it matches yours, don't you?" "Yes." And a question occurred to me, one of some import, maybe. "Wireman, did you have any of these telepathic bursts, weird receptions, whatever you want to call them, before you came to Duma Key?" I was thinking of Monica Goldstein's dog, Gandalf, and how I seemed to have choked him with an arm I no longer had. "Yes, two or three," he said. "I may tell you about them in time, Edgar, but I don't want to stick Jack with Miss Eastlake for too long. All other considerations aside, she's apt to be worried about me. She's a dear thing." I could have said that Jack, also sort of a dear thing, would probably be worried too, but instead I only told him to go on. "You often have a redness about you, muchacho," Wireman said. "I don't think it's an aura, exactly, and it's not exactly a thought, except when it is. I've gotten it from you as a word, as well as a color on three or four occasions. And yes, once when I was off Duma Key, when we were at the Skoto, when I was stuck for a word. Were you? I don't remember." "Neither do I, but I'm sure that was it. Red's a mnemonic for me, a trigger, from a Reba McEntire song, of all things. I found it almost by accident. And there's something else, I guess. When I forget stuff, I tend to get, you know, a little pissed off." I thought of how I'd taken Pam by the throat, how I'd tried to choke her. "Yeah," I said, "you could say that." "Ah. Anyway, I guess that red must have gotten out and stained my mental suit of clothes. Is that what it's like?" "Close. And every time I sense that around you, in you, I think of waking up after putting a bullet in my temple and seeing the whole world was dark red. I thought I was in hell. That was what hell was going to be like, an eternity of deepest scarlet." He paused. "Then I realized it was just the apple. It was lying right in front of me, maybe an inch from my eyes. It was on the floor, and I was on the floor." "I'll be damned," I said. Yes, that's what I thought. But it wasn't damnation, only an apple. In Adam's fall sinned we all. I said that out loud. Then I said, fruit bowl. I remember everything that happened and everything that was said over the next 96 hours with perfect clarity. Every detail. He laughed. Of course, I know some of the things I remember aren't true, but I remember them with exquisite precision all the same. No cross-examination could trip me up to this very day, not even concerning the pus-covered roaches I saw crawling out of old Jack Finham's eyes, mouth, and nostrils. I had a hell of a headache, but once I got over the shock of the apple close-up, I felt pretty much okay otherwise. It was 4 in the morning. 6 hours had gone by. I was lying in a puddle of congealed blood. It was caked on my right cheek like jelly. I remember sitting up and saying, I'm a dandy in aspic, and trying to remember if aspic was some kind of jelly. I said, no jelly in the fruit bowl. And saying that seemed so rational, it was like passing a sanity test. I began to doubt that I'd shot myself. It seemed more likely that I'd gone to sleep at the dining room table only thinking of shooting myself, fallen off my chair and hit my head. That's where the blood came from. In fact, it seemed almost certain, given the fact that I was moving around and talking. I told myself to say something else, to say my mother's name. Instead, I said, cash crop in the ground, landlord, soon be round. I nodded, excited. I'd had similar experiences, not once but countless times after coming out of my coma. Sit in the buddy, sit in the chum. Were you angry? No, serene, relieved. I could accept a little disorientation from a knock on the head. Only then I saw the gun on the floor. I picked it up and smelled the muzzle. There's no mistaking the smell of a recently fired gun. It's acrid, a smell with claws. Still, I held on to the falling asleep and hitting my head idea until I got into the bathroom and saw the hole in my temple. Little round hole with a corona of singe marks around it. He laughed again, as people do when remembering some crazy boner they pulled. Forgetting to open the garage door, for instance, and then backing into it. That's when I heard the last number clicking into place, Edgar. The Powerball number, and I knew I was going to Disney World after all. Or a reasonable facsimile, I said. Christ, Wireman. I tried to wash the powder burns off, but bearing down with a face cloth hurt too much. It was like biting down on a bad tooth. Suddenly I understood why they'd x-rayed him, instead of sticking him in the MRI machine. The bullet was still in his head. Wireman, can I ask you something? All right. Are a person's optic nerves, I don't know, bass-ackwards? Indeed they are. So that's why your left eye is fucked up. It's like... For a moment the word wouldn't come, and I clenched my fist. Then it was there. It's like contra-coup. I guess so, yeah. I shot myself on the right side of my stupid head, but it's my left eye that's fucked up. I put a band-aid over the hole and took some aspirin. I laughed. I couldn't help it. Wireman smiled and nodded. Then I went to bed and tried to sleep. I might as well have tried sleeping in the middle of a brass band. I didn't sleep for 4 days. I felt I would never sleep again. My mind was going 4,000 miles an hour. This made cocaine seem like Xanax. I couldn't even lie still for long. I managed 20 minutes, then leaped up and put on a mariachi record. It was 5:30 in the morning. I spent 30 minutes on the exercise bike, first time I'd been on it since Julia Inez died, showered, and went into work. For the next 3 days, I was a bird, I was a plane, I was super lawyer. My colleagues progressed from being worried about me to being scared for me to being scared for themselves. The non-sequiturs were getting worse, and so was my tendency to lapse into both pidgin Spanish and a kind of Pepe Le Pew French. But there can be no doubt that I moved a mountain of paper during those days, and very little of it ever came back on the firm. I checked. The partners in the corner offices and the lawyers in the trenches were united in the belief that I was having a nervous breakdown, and in a sense they were right. It was an organic nervous breakdown. Several people tried to get me to go home, with no success. Dion Knightley, one of my good friends there, all but begged me to let him take me to see a doctor. Know what I told him? I shook my head. Corn in the field, deal soon sealed.
I remember it perfectly. Then I walked away, except I was almost skipping. Walking was too slow for wiremen. I pulled two all-nighters. The third night, the security guard is